This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
If you have health insurance, you might be able to see a personal dietitian for $0 out of pocket. Nourish connects you with a dietitian that fits your needs, covered by your insurance. Nourish accepts hundreds of insurance plans, and 94% of patients pay $0 out of pocket. Meet with your dietitian online and message them anytime through the Nourish app. With hundreds of five-star reviews from real patients, you know you're in good hands. Find your dietitian at usenourish.com. That's usenourish.com.
Yeah, sure thing.
Hey, you sold that car yet?
Yeah, sold it to Carvana.
Oh, I thought you were selling to that guy.
The guy who wanted to pay me in foreign currency, no interest over 36 months? Yeah, no. Carvana gave me an offer in minutes, picked it up, and paid me on the spot. It was so convenient.
Just like that?
Yeah.
No hassle?
None.
That is super convenient.
Sell your car to Carvana and swap hassle for convenience. Pickup fees may apply.
Where'd you get those shoes? Easy. They're from DSW. Because DSW has the exact right shoes for whatever you're into right now. You know, like the sneakers that make office hours feel like happy hour. The boots that turn grocery aisles into runways. And all the styles that show off the many sides of you. From daydreamer to multitasker and everything in between. Because you do it all in really great shoes. Find a shoe for every you at your DSW store or DSW.com.
Welcome, everybody. My name is Dave Glover. I'm the host of The Dave Glover Show on KMOX in St. Louis from 1 to 5 p.m. My good friend and partner here is Trish Gazelle. She does middays on KZK in St. Louis. I've been doing this for 25 years. Trish, you've been doing this more like 30?
Excuse me? Don't age me. I don't know. Late 90s, let's just say that.
So much older than me. That's what we're trying to say. So Trish and I are great friends, and she was on my show for a couple of years. And we have both suffered losses in the past few years. And I have begun working as a hospice volunteer. I'll tell you that story here in a second. And that has really led to me feeling and looking into grief and listening to a couple of podcasts, and I decided to do it myself and wanted Trish to do it with me, tell our stories, have a couple of guests on, and it's very informal. Neither of us are experts, neither of us are psychologists or doctors or death doulas or anything like that, but we will talk to an expert. We'll talk to a chaplain with an organization I'm a part of called NODA, No One Dies Alone, which is a wonderful organization that sits vigil with people in their last couple, 3 days while they are passing away, when the family needs rest. And they will spend the entire night with them. And Dr. Strassman is the chaplain of that, and we'll get into grief with her. So,
yeah,
let's tell our stories.
Well, I think that, too, this is going to be good for people who suffered a loss, and it could be a year ago, it could be 2 months ago, it could be 5 years ago, that are still kind of coming to terms with it. And like I said to you, it's like so weird talking to people and trying to be normal while you're thinking about this. And they're like, oh, what's wrong? And you can't really go, well, I'm still dealing with my dad's death 2 years ago.
Yeah.
But I am.
Yeah.
You know?
We all have internal time mechanisms that if you have a breakup in a romantic relationship, you go, this is going to really be terrible for 6 months, and then it's going to be awkward for 6 months. But after a year, I should be, you know, you have like a general sense of that. With grief, you may also have a sense of that. I would throw that away, because whatever you think it's going to be, it's not going to be. Right? I think
completely.
It's idiosyncratic to every single person. The death of my father in 2002 and my brother in 2002 were very different from each other and very different from my mom. And the way I grieved them has been different. And so I think that's the first point I would make, just as a normal person who's gone through it, is that not lower your expectations, just don't have them. Don't put expectations on yourself.
But I think that may have been one of my problems. I mean, no one wants to walk around and think about, oh my gosh, someone dying in my family. I just never thought. I mean, did I think my dad was going to live forever? I think I thought that. I just never thought about it. It wasn't on the table. He was 85. I spent 50 years with him. Like, I just didn't think. And I'll just go ahead and tell my story. Mine happened really fast. It was after COVID, the tail end, and I was living by myself. And my parents were both in their 80s. And I was like, oh, I'm not doing anything. They're moving slow. And I said, I think you guys could use some help. And they both said yes. So I moved in with them. It was great. You know, before that, I lived at home until I was 28 and then got married. So I moved right from my parents' house to my husband's house. And we just always got along. I have three older sisters. We're a very close family. So I was living with them. And looking back, I think I knew that my dad wasn't feeling well. But I just, again, just never thought it was something bad. And so after about a year of living with them, which would be 2 years ago now, my dad just woke up in the middle of the night and I could hear him calling for me. And I went in there and he literally couldn't move. Like, he was on his bed and he was trying to get up and go to the bathroom, and his body just wouldn't move. And I'm trying to get him back on the bed, and he kind of slid to the floor. Now, this is not a traumatic thing that's happening. We're joking. We're laughing. He's yelling at me. I'm yelling back, again, laughing. And he was on the floor. And at one point, I'm like, Dad, I got to call somebody. Something's wrong. And he looked at me and he goes, I know. I'm on the floor. And we both just started laughing. And, you know, then the paramedics came, and because we called 911, I'm like, you have to let me call someone. If this happens again, Mom and I cannot get you up. So they took him to the hospital, and that is the last that he never talked again. Like, I still keep thinking about it. Like, did his body just shut down? Was he just fighting every day? So anyway, we're all at the hospital, and the doctor came in and he's like, I'm so sorry, but he has cancer so bad that it's like eating into his ribs. And we're all just like, what? I mean, complete shock. And I was like, okay, well, what do we do? How much does he have? Months? Does he have years? And he just said today. And I mean, like, so we were there when he took his last breath, and it's just, I keep going over it. Like, did he just, like, I've been fighting so hard, I just can't do it anymore, you know? And you have a lot of experience, and I guess when we talk to someone from NODA, like, did he just say, okay, I have to give up now? I mean, I remember when we were all, you know, sitting around him, and, you know, we all had our hands on him, and I told my sister, I'm like, tell him it's okay, like, he can go, we're okay. And, you know, like, a couple minutes after that, you know, he took his last breath. But I have so many things I want to say here. One is, like, that was very traumatic, obviously, and I don't understand how we were fighting 1 minute and laughing to never talking again. And then it makes me think of all the people who have lost someone suddenly who don't get that last moment. Or, you know, I think about you going through, like, your dad and your brother, or people who've lost their parents when they were younger, or a parent who lost a child. Like, I just keep running all these scenarios through my head. Like, I just never understood it the way I understand it now.
Yeah.
And even 2 years later, my mom and I will both, like, we can't believe it. We can't believe he's gone. And then that makes me think about her. And, you know, is she, like, I can't help but feel like she's now thinking, well, my time has come. And I hate that she has to think that, you know? I just, like, I know I'm spitting out a lot of thoughts here, but it's like everything that goes through your mind. And 2 years later, I'm still thinking about it. It's still such a huge hole in my life. And, like, I don't know who I am now since that. Like, I'm a different person.
Yeah. Yeah. It seems like it went from death being something that at best you sort of glanced at now and then looked away, to really defining your life.
I mean, and again, what was I, stupid? But, I mean, I don't think people should walk around every day and go, oh my gosh, this is going to happen.
Any day.
But I just, like, it wasn't even on, it wasn't an option.
Yeah.
It wasn't on the table. And maybe it should have been a little bit.
Yeah.
I
think it's interesting, too. So I loved my mom and dad dearly, but I came from a challenging home. It was a challenging childhood. You, on the other hand, and you and I know each other very well, you have such a wonderful family and such wonderful parents. And they were, especially your dad, just larger than life, almost like a 70s sitcom kind of thing, which I can't relate to.
But it still doesn't make it any easier.
I think it probably makes it harder.
Right?
Yeah. It's not like when my parents passed away, I was like, oh, good riddance. Not at all. But for you, especially with your dad, it was just such a sea change in your life. And being one of your best friends, I know that you haven't really got your sea legs even a couple years later.
I have not. Like, I always do better in life when I have my center, and they were my center. I knew... And I was blessed in that way. I know not everyone, and even, you know, like you said, has the privilege of having wonderful parents. But I just knew if anything happened, I could go there. They'd have my back. They would do it, you know, and I just, obviously my mom's still here and I love her to death, but it's just different. And I don't know how to live without that part of my life. And I know it's going to happen again.
Yeah.
And that's what... really gets me, and I think about it every day. And you know, I think anybody who's gone through this, you think about the last thing she said, and the last week, and was I as nice as I could have been? Could I have done more? Should I have spotted it? I mean, you just run through everything. I also want to say to you, like, it gives, you don't know until you know. And with friends like you or any other of my friends who have had losses before, I don't think I gave enough to them because I didn't know. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yes.
Like, I wasn't as sympathetic as I could have been, or I didn't reach out as much as I could have. I just didn't know.
Yeah.
You don't know until you know.
So my mom passed away July 26th of 2024 at 96, just a few weeks before her 97th birthday. And my dad had passed away from Alzheimer's in 2002, which was a huge loss. They'd been married since, I think, 1946. And then my brother took his own life Christmas Eve of the same year. So there's a lot to unpack there.
The same year as your dad.
It's my dad.
So you lost your dad, and then you lost your brother.
Yeah, lost my dad in March. Lost my brother to suicide Christmas time of 2002, the same year. And he was 11 years older than me. And so that was a lot. Losing your first parent, which puts you in the club, right? I mean, that's, as you know.
But then are you just worried about, like, your mom at that point? Like,
I wasn't actively, because she was in her mid-70s, and we have a lot of longevity in our family, and so I figured she was going to make it to her 90s, and she did. She was 4'6", 70 pounds of pure fury, but she made it to almost 100 years old. And losing my dad and losing my brother in no way prepared me for losing my mom. And like I said, it was a difficult childhood, and my mom and I had a complicated relationship, but I had done my best to take care of her after losing my dad. And she lived about an hour away. You know, I live in St. Louis. She lived over in Illinois, but I would go see her once or twice a week and try to call her every day. And I didn't make it every single day, but I would try really hard. So we were close. And like you're talking about, what was your last thing? My mom and I didn't really fight, other than like when I was a teenager, silly fights. But we got into it about 6 months before she passed away. Because what happened was she fell, like so many older people do. She fell on opening day of baseball season 2024. I'll never forget that. And 4 months later, and she broke her hip, and 4 months later, she was gone. But about 6 months before that, we'd gotten into sort of a fight, and she was a difficult person. And I remember asking her, like, okay, I'm going to ask you something, and I want you to really think about it. Have you ever been wrong in your life And have you ever apologized to anyone? And there was this long pause, so long that I started to ask it again. So I thought she didn't hear me. And she goes, no. And I'm blown away. And I'm like, to which one? She's like, neither.
Were you mad or were you laughing?
I was both. I was shocked. I was just shocked.
Never been wrong.
That any person, much less someone who's lived almost a century, had never wronged a person. And so that sort of defined my mom and probably defines a lot of people's parents out there. Like, there are people out there right now shaking their head like, yeah, I know that person. But then, so I, whether it was my place to step up as the new leader of the family or the patriarch or whatever, I did that. And my son and I went to see her a lot in the nursing home. And like so many people, when she had the surgery, she came out and she was in some sort of post-surgery delirium. And it just never went away. Mm. So it presented a lot like Alzheimer's. But she knew who we were until the very end, which was a gift. She just thought she was living in 1940s Benton, Illinois. You know, people taking her to parties and not picking her up. She had lots of complaints. But then my hospice work, which I think is important to this, at least for my story, about 2 days before she passed, and you know, if you've been through hospice, they start showing signs. And they said, we think she has about 48 hours, and you guys have been here 12 hours a day. You need to go home, and you need to get some rest, get a meal, get some sleep. And we have this volunteer group called NODA, No One Dies Alone, and they're going to sit in two-hour shifts with your mom all night. And they might as well have told me, we have a talking porcupine who plays the banjo. Like, it just didn't make any sense. Like, who are these people? Why would they do that? Yeah. I don't understand. I went and I bought a bunch of honey buns and sodas and put them in this box for them. And so they were with her the second night when she passed away at about 4 a.m. And I was so moved by that, that a couple weeks later, I decided that to honor my mom and her memory and to pay it forward, that I would become a volunteer for NODA. So long story short, I took all the training, and which was pretty substantial. And for about 3-4 months now, I have been visiting hospice patients who are not emergently dying, which is a weird term, but that's kind of what we say, just to take them cookies and read to them and be their friend and give them something to look forward to once a week. And then we'll get a text about once every 2 weeks saying that a vigil has been requested. And so someone's dying. And then we go in and I go in and you spend 2 hours, and sometimes they're usually not communicative. Sometimes you hold their hand. Sometimes you play music. Sometimes you talk to them. It's just really what you feel. But that's been incredible. But I hate to just take up all the time here, but death has always played such a big role in my life. I don't think I've ever told you the story, but when I was 12-ish, 13 maybe, I was at a relative's funeral down in Benton, Illinois, where my mom and dad are both from. And with my cousins, we were kind of running around. We'd, you know, already been there for a few hours. Somehow I made it into the room where they do all of the preparation for the bodies. And my cousins thought it would be funny to lock me in there.
Ugh.
Yeah. And so there were no bodies in there, thank God. But it was the nightmare fuel for a 12 or 13-year-old, which led to a lifelong sort of obsession with death and dead bodies. And what do you do with them? And what do they look like? And I'm afraid of it. Like, I'm more afraid of dying people than I am of vampires or something. And so it has been challenging, but really rewarding, because given what we do, being radio personalities, we do a lot of charitable work and we go and we host things and MC events and things like that. And we get too much credit for helping to raise money and whatnot. And I had always felt like it was pretty performative on my part. And so this was important to me. Personally, to do something I didn't want to do. This goes against my grain. It's scary to me. It's weird to me. And I didn't know if I'd be able to do it. So I took all the training. And then I sat with my first gentleman, whose name was Ray. And immediately I was comfortable. Mm. It was the craziest thing. and he was a Beatles fan. I was playing him Beatles songs off my phone, and he would smile, and I was trying to make him laugh, which sounds weird, but he was smiling and kind of, you know, like laughing as much as you can at that moment. And it just, like, the next day I told my trainers, there's everything I've ever done up until this point, and then they're sitting with Ray. That's a completely separate thing that was so much more meaningful than 99% of the stuff I've done in my life. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know you've talked about this before, and if people have listened to the Dave Glover show, they've heard this before, but what you're doing is so admirable and selfless and good, and I wish I could do it, and I don't know that I can, and I bet there's a lot of people out there thinking that. I would love to be able to. I feel like my grief is so palpable still that, and you're forming connections with these people that, you know, you're going to experience loss over and over again. And I just emotionally don't know if I'm there yet. Is there, like, you know, and I've asked you this before, and I don't know if I heard the answer correctly, but if people want to help Noda but don't know that they can do that part of it, is there anything else we could do if we're just not there yet?
There are people who do the vigils. That's sort of the Navy SEALs, right? The people who
that's
go
for
in.
End of life.
Yes. And then there are people who do what's called care and comfort, which is the other thing I do, which is visiting patients. They'll assign you a couple of patients. You get
so
to know
that
them.
You wouldn't be there necessarily at
you
the moment.
You don't have to be there at the moment they pass, no. And then there are people who just send cards. Like, they literally, they just write, hey, I hope you're doing well and feeling good. But I can tell you, having spent too much time, I'm 60, I'm spending too much time in nursing homes for a 60-year-old. But even the best of them, even the nice ones, because we've both been to not nice ones.
Right.
Even the nice ones, they're still nursing homes. And people are still kind of alone. And there's some people who are completely alone. Like, there are people, I'd visit my mom, you know, once or twice a day for the 4 months that she was in a Bethesda nursing home. And there were people who never saw a person. And so I just think it's such a...
So you can do the care and comfort where you just go visit and just have a visit and it's not your... Yeah. And I know there's other people probably thinking that. That was my exact experience waiting for my dad's last breath.
Yes.
That I just don't know if I can do that
I
yet.
I get it.
And I'm sorry, and I wish I could, and I wish I could buck up. But I would like to be able to do the other things, because I think it's, like you said, I mean, I can't imagine someone laying there with... Yeah. No one visiting them. That's horrible to think about.
What do you feel like? I always feel like inside we kind of have our answers. They may be uncomfortable for us. What do you feel like you need?
I don't know. And that's the thing. Like, no one can do anything for me. Like, there's nothing anyone can do. Like, I just need to, I guess, come to terms with it. I don't know. It's just such a huge hole in my life. I don't know. I don't know what I need. I guess time. You know, I still can't look at pictures because I feel like I do not look at pictures. I feel like I'm going to break down and cry and never stop. That's what it feels like.
Have you let yourself do that?
I mean, you know, I think about it every day. There's not a day that goes by that I don't think about it. And yes, I mean, I've cried, but not like, you know, a 2-year-old on the floor. And no. And I don't feel like I can do it right now. I don't feel like I'll be able to stop. I just, and you know, and I keep thinking about, like, again, other people, like, this is not a good trait. It's not like, oh, she's thinking about other people. I do it too much. Like, you know, my friends who lost a parent when they were in high school or college, or a parent who's lost a child. I mean, I don't know how you come back from, it's heartbreaking. Loss is heartbreaking. And it's got me thinking about my own mortality. And I don't know what that means yet. You know, I'm still trying to figure it out.
Yeah. Not to just make this about you or give you unsolicited advice, but everyone in your position, at some point you have to start living your life. Because at some point, you're going to be the one in the hospice bed.
Yeah.
It's just the way it works.
Yeah, sorry.
And I get that your timing is not the same as other people's timing. Other people may want you, hey, it's time to move on. It's time to do this. It's time to, you know, get this in your life.
Well, I'm performing the motions. It's not like it's stopping me from doing anything.
Which is an interesting, which is an interesting concept.
Yeah,
I mean, kind of going through because you do feel, again, to use that term, performative, like you're putting on a happy face. Yeah. You're coming in. You're doing a radio show.
Now I don't want to make it sound like every day I'm just like, it's just on my mind every day, and I'm still living my life, and I'm still, you know, having happy moments, and I'm not, you know, I'm probably a little depressed about it, yes, but it's not halting my life. I just want to say that when it happens to you, and for anyone out there, don't you feel like, you know, you should wear a sign like this happened to me, like right. Something should stop. The world should not just go on. You feel like there should be like, hello, a neon sign flashing like this happened to me and I'm still sad about it.
Like in the olden days, they would dress in black for a year.
Yeah.
Which let people know, oh, that's the widow McGillicuddy and she's still mourning her husband, Jess, you know. I saw something... like a meme or a quote or something right after my mom passed, because you know how TikTok is. It knows what you're going through. And it said something to the effect of, my world stopped when you died, but the world didn't stop.
Right.
And I remember thinking that's so true.
And it feels like it should. Yeah, it feels like something should be different, and that's not real life. I mean... You know, we're talking about this, obviously, because this is what this podcast is centered around. I'm able to, you know, live my life. It's just, I know that there's other people, you know, that this weighs heavy on them. Again, I like the people who lose parents when they were younger. I go through that scenario, too. Would I have wanted it that way? Would I have wanted it quick? Would I have wanted it, you know, you just think about these things. And again, if you've lost one person like you did back when your dad and or two people and your brother, then you know it's coming again.
Yeah.
I know now what to expect, but I don't want to do it again.
Yeah.
I don't want to do it again.
Yeah. Yeah, you're in a position where you're grieving your dad and you're fearing your mom.
I mean, I'm sure you were like that for...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Although I was like with my mom, even though she was in her upper 90s, we never had a Christmas for 15 years where she didn't announce to everyone, this is my last Christmas. Like it was like she knew the date and the time. Which, given my mom,
did she want from that?
Who knows?
Some attention?
Attention or like
extra present? I don't know.
To fall down and scream, ball, cry, or, you know, rip our clothing or something. But in spite of her advanced age and her tininess and her announcing every Christmas season that it was her last holiday, I just didn't believe it would happen.
Same thing I'm saying, yeah.
And that's an important point to make here, I think, is that I'm sure there are other things in life like this, the birth of a child, marriage, divorce, whatever. But you can be a smart person, a capable person, an introspective, self-reflecting person who knows themselves and knows what's happening with their loved one. And still be completely oblivious to it until it happens.
Yeah.
Like, I was lying in bed at 3:53 in the morning the night my mom passed and the phone rang. And I knew. Of course you know. Because there's someone sitting with your dying parent and it's 3:53 in the morning, which is when people die. And I just knew it. And yet, I answered the phone. So we all know how long it takes to answer a phone before it goes to voicemail. But I swear it felt like I sat there for an hour watching that number, that unknown number that I knew.
You knew when you picked
a stranger was about to tell me my mom had died. And then, even though there's this amazing organization sitting with her, I still immediately felt guilty that I wasn't there. But I'll be really honest with you, even though I've not been there for someone actually passing. I've been there too. I'm sort of like a cat at a nursing home. Like when I go in your room, you know it's time. Like I've missed people by 5 or 10 minutes.
Oh man.
But it just in some ways I didn't want to be there. Yeah. And I had to admit that to myself.
Yeah.
And I think I'm a natural caretaker. I think I was pretty good at helping her and shepherding her through those 4 months. I feel proud of that.
Yeah.
We put on a good funeral. But again, I'm going to use it for the third time. I'm a performer. You know this. It's what I do. And so that was natural for me. Okay, your mom passed away. You need to let everyone know in the listening audience. You need to let relatives know. You need to pick out a dress for her. You need to, all that stuff. I'm good at that. I'm good at events. But then when the funeral's over and the mercy meal's over, and you go then home what? And there's no one to perform for, there's no one to be there for, it's just you.
That's hard.
That's rough.
I got to tell you one more thing. When we were all in the hospital room and there was like 11 people in there because it was all my sisters and their husbands and the grandkids, we were all there. And I still, even though the guy told me it was today, the guy, the doctor, I still was like, we were having, it still didn't really sink in. So anyway, the priest comes and does his blessing. And then I'm sitting next to my dad and I'm holding his hand and I'm rubbing his head. I'm like, why is he sweating? And I'm wiping off his forehead. And they looked at me. They're like, the priest just put oil on his forehead. And I wiped it all off. And then we all started laughing.
Can you tell the funny thing that your brother-in-law said?
Oh, my God. So I have three sisters, four girls, obviously. My dad was outnumbered. So we're all fighting to be. My dad did not talk a lot. But, when he said stuff, we were all like, what, Dad? Like, it was the most important thing ever. So we're all fighting over who could be the favorite all the time. Anytime we called, oh, it's your favorite. And he'd go, Krista, like, call me by the wrong name, like, just kidding around. So we're all trying to be the favorite. So in the hospital, my brother-in-law, Vinny, was next to him holding his hand. He goes, your dad just said, and we were trying to get him to talk the whole time and wake up. And the nurse said, just keep talking to him. So we were trying to get him to talk the whole time. And Vinny was like right by his head. And he's like, oh, my God, your dad just said something. We're all like, what? What did he say? And he goes, that Linda was the favorite. We were all like, ah, Vinny. And we all started laughing. I don't know if that translates, but.
I love that.
Yeah, it was a moment that was needed at the time.
Yeah.
Which might sound weird to some people, but that's just how my family is. So,
before we talk to a guest here, even though you admittedly have struggled with this, but you've been through it. Like, you are a veteran of this. You have earned it. If someone were facing this now that they know they're going to lose a loved one because they're terminal or they just did, based on your experience, what advice can you give?
Oh, gosh.
Nothing?
I just, like, just be with your family, be with your friends. It doesn't mean you have to talk about, like, you know, it doesn't mean you have to talk about it, but just, you know, spend time with friends. Again, there's nothing anyone can do for me, and I really don't know what to do. It's just be comforted by the people surrounding you. Just go out, have dinner, sit on the couch, talk to people, be near people. That's it. Like, that's the only advice I can give right now. I know it was 2 years ago, but I feel like I'm still too close to it.
Yeah.
I don't know what to do. Like, it's just that. Just be comforted by the people around you.
I don't think that my hospice work would make it easier to lose someone else in my family. But it has demystified the process and made it seem so much more natural, not like the moment someone passes away, just the fact of it.
Yeah.
That it's something that when you're a little kid and you realize for the first time that people die, you know, you go to your first funeral, like, what's this? Well, they died. What is that? They're in heaven or they're just not here anymore. From that time, obviously, it's just this gigantic thing in our path that's hopefully decades down the road, but it's so huge, right? It's almost indefinably huge, and we make movies about it, and we write stories about it, and we sing songs about it, and we always have, that confronting it the way I have with other people through No One Dies Alone hasn't fixed it, but it's definitely made it something I can look at.
Easier to think about.
Yeah, does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Like, there's some horror movies, like, I can't look at The Exorcist. I can't even look at a picture of the little girl. Can't do it. That's how death used to be to me. Now I can look at it. Mm. It's not much prettier, but it makes it a little more, okay, I can do this.
Yeah. I mean, just you doing that is really selfless again and so good of you. And I just, there's some people who aren't there yet. And if anyone's thinking about Noda, I'm glad you brought up just the care and comfort part too, or the cards. I mean, yeah. That's just a way to let somebody know.
And I have to say this, as I know this is such a cliche, that you hear people, especially people my age, say, oh, it's what you do for other people, and get out there and volunteer. It's the best thing you'll ever do. Sometimes cliches are cliches because they're true.
Yeah.
And this has really helped me. The biggest thing that's helped me to deal with my grief of losing my mom, who is the last person above me in my family, right? My sister's still with us. She's 14 years older than me, but like in an authority sort right. of figure, losing mm-hmm. your parents. It's really helped me to manage it. I hate that word, but it kind of comes down to that sometimes.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. Indeed sponsored jobs help you stand out and hire fast. With sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. And it makes a huge difference. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Plus, with Indeed sponsored jobs, there are no monthly subscriptions, no long-term contracts, and you only pay for results. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/listen. Just go to Indeed.com/listen right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/listen. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
This President's Day, upgrade the look of your home without breaking your budget. Save up to 40% site-wide on brand new window treatments now at Blinds.com. Blinds.com, the number one online retailer of custom window treatments, is the better way to give your home the presidential treatment. Blinds.com makes it easy with free virtual consultations on your schedule and samples delivered directly to your door, fast and free. Choose from trending woven wood shades or upgrade to motorized. Blinds.com has everything and more, all with upfront pricing and no hidden fees. Need help with installation? Blinds.com can handle it for you. Or DIY with expert guidance from our design pros. With over 25 million windows covered and our 100% satisfaction guarantee, you can count on Blinds.com to deliver results you'll love. Shop Blinds.com's President's Day Mega Sale Last Chance right now and save up to 40% site-wide, plus a free professional measure. Up to 40% off site-wide at Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof like Aloe, Allbirds, or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling and for shoppers buying simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet and the not-so-secret secret with Shop Pay that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going. So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell whenever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout experience as business powerhouses like Aloe, Allbirds, and Skims. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/odysseypodcast, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/odysseypodcast to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/odysseypodcast.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. Indeed sponsored jobs help you stand out and hire fast. With sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. And it makes a huge difference. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Plus, with Indeed sponsored jobs, there are no monthly subscriptions, no long-term contracts, and you only pay for results. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/listen. Just go to Indeed.com/listen right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/listen. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Hey, I'm Ben Stiller.
I'm Adam Scott.
And we make a TV show called Severance. Severance is back for season 2 on Apple TV+.
Before the premiere, Ben and I are going to be binging season 1 and putting out daily recaps. And after that, we're going to keep going as we recap every episode of season 2.
The Severance podcast with Ben Stiller and Adam Scott is presented by State Farm. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Listen and follow now on Apple Podcasts, the Odyssey app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, we're going to bring in a friend of ours. He is a member of our team here in St. Louis. He's an awfully young man to be called legendary, but he's been on KMOX how many years now, Tommy?
Well, this is coming up on 28.
28 years. Yeah. And he's only 32.
It was an amazing experience.
Dookie Hauser of radio. Yeah. Tom is great friends with Trish and I, and Tom has a story to tell. He lost his dad at a very young age. How old were you, Tom?
I was almost 18. Yeah, I was 17, just about to turn 18, summer of 93.
That's what I when I was 50, obviously, and I just keep thinking now about friends I knew who lost a parent when they were younger. You losing... just how hard that would be at that age. I'm having a hard enough time at 50. What was it like when you were 18?
Yeah, and you go through different stages too. Like right now, it's not as painful as it was, but I still have moments of sadness because, you know, my kids are at the age now, 18, 14, that my sister and I were when he passed away. So I start to think about now looking at things from his age and perspective, and that makes me emotional. And it also, you know, of course I wish that he could have seen me get married and see my kids grow up and all of those things. At that time, it was an absolute shock. My dad was, we were very, very close. I mean, he's, you know, he and my mom and my sister, we were all very, very tight. My dad introduced me to sports. I traveled around the country with my dad to sporting events. I got to meet some really neat people, coaches, because of his fanship and level of interest in sports. He became very close. He was a great athlete himself in high school. We were very tight, and I had just graduated from high school. He had seen me graduate from high school, and This is now early summer, 93, June of 93. And one morning, he had a heart attack in our house. It was early in the morning. I was asleep, but I woke up and something felt off, and I thought I heard something downstairs. And I went downstairs, and my mom was on the phone with 911 and giving him CPR. Mm. So I jumped in and helped. And we both were talking to first responders. We lived across the street from Mercy Hospital, so they were there in like 2 seconds, but it felt like 2 hours, you know. And he
was your dad awake at all?
He was. The doctor said that he had had a massive heart attack and he was already gone when we were attempting that. So it was very shocking and sudden, and something that, you know, it was hard to get past. It happened, you know, in our sunroom that we would all hang out and have holiday dinners in, you know, and right in the front of our house. So, you know, it was a tough one for sure. I was almost 18 years old. My sister was 14. And suddenly I was without a dad and I was getting ready to go to college. And, you know, going back on it, I just remember like flashes of the week. So it's hard for me to actually remember the funeral even. And I remember a flood of response from my friends and, of course, our family's friends. But I think I was so emotional and sort of disoriented and in shock that my brain actually, I can't remember some of the week. I really can't.
Tom, did you think at all about not going away to college?
Absolutely. I actually went to my mom and I said, I want to be here with you. And then I would say, I I just don't think I want to go. And she said, no, you are going to go. And she had a great support group of our very close friends. My dad had a lot of friends around the country who remain my friends today. They're like, you know, I became their son. So I have like a dad in New York and I have a dad, you know, here and a dad there. And so they all came together just like I would imagine my friends would for me. They were a very tight group. And so she felt comfortable that she had enough support to go through all the things that had to happen now legally and financially. And there was a lot of stuff going on that she felt like she would be able to do. And that was a lot to put on my mom, but, you know, and my sister, to be able to see her through high school. But I did. I went on to college in Indiana and reluctantly, but I'm glad that she pushed me to do it because I went to IU. It's the four of the greatest years of my life. It's actually where I grew up, where I spent a lot of emotion, where I cried a lot, and but also where I met some great people who changed me because I was changing at the time. You know, a lot of people say, you know, now you're the man of the house. You know, you're going to become a man. I really did. I mean, a lot of my kid thoughts went away. And I was an adult now at 18 helping my family. But being in Indiana and being going through those college years, now every time I go back to Bloomington, I think about that. That is not just my college. That's where I truly grew up and where I spent a lot of emotion.
Even now, so many years later, I mean, obviously, I'm going to say the obvious here. It's just so weird that you have someone and then you go to sleep and you don't. I mean, that it just messes with you. But even now, do you replay like the last things you said or, you know, maybe your last conversation the night before?
I remember us having a conversation the night before and it being kind of like funny about something about my friends or something. I think I was going out with some buddies and I can't remember the specific line, but he said something that made me laugh. And then, you know, it was the last thing that he said to me. I know that, you know, a couple of weeks before that was Father's Day and we actually went to, we did a lot of great things over those years. We went to Indiana together to go look at the campus. And I just remember that he was Mr. Mizzou. I mean, my dad was a tiger all the way through, wanted me to go to Mizzou. He was the co-founder of Sunshine Drapery. His name was Bill Ackerman. And I was going to join the drapery business. That's what I was going to do. I was going to help work in that company.
I didn't know he founded that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But he, and they, you know, they started it. He and his partner started out of a garage, you know, and built this thing into a company just out of sheer hard work and determination. And I was going to, you know, be in line to join that. But I wanted in my heart to be a broadcaster. And my dad supported that. He did not say, no, you can't do that. You have to do this. He completely 100% supported my dream to be a broadcaster to the point where not only did he accept that, but he accepted that I fell in love with Indiana and didn't want to go to his beloved alma mater of Mizzou. And he said, I'm in, let's go check it out and let's go do this. Now, you know, it's going to be a competitive business, right? You know, it's different. And I said, yeah, I know that, Dad. And he said, well, I want to support you and do that. I think about that all the time. That visit, that time right around Father's Day. And of course, had I known then that it would be our last Father's Day, I mean, it takes even on more meaning. But I do think about that a lot. How he just said, okay. And he had watched me, you know, since I was like 5 years old, watching these broadcasters on TV and mimicking them and trying to be them. So he knew that that was always in my heart, but it never left. I always wanted to do it. And he allowed me and supported my dream. And that really meant a lot to me. And that is something that I think about a lot. I really do. I mean, the hard part, of course, is the loss and, you know, the actual moment of seeing him and all those snapshots are in my mind. But like I said, I for whatever reason, you know, a lot of the heartache and everything that I went through those few weeks are very, like, it's hard for me to remember some of it. That's how my brain worked.
What advice would you give to a contemporary who their child has lost a parent? Say that you have a buddy who lost his wife and the kids are teenagers, and now you have to parent a teenager who's just lost a parent. Having been through that, what advice, if any, could you give to that parent?
Boy, it's a really good question. I've absolutely talked to a lot of kids about that situation. I've talked to a lot of kids who have lost their parents and have, you know, guided them through some of those things. But I haven't really talked to the parents about how to handle, and this is kind of what we were just talking about, now that I'm the age, you know, my dad was 54, so I'm about to turn 50. So now I'm starting to think about that. How would I handle that as a parent? I think that it is important to listen to your kids and let them give those emotions. I would say to understand that they will go through a variety of emotions. Kids just do anyway at that age. I mean, I went through sadness and then anger and then sadness again, and then fear, and like all these things kept going through my head from week to week to week until it did eventually calm. But it took a long, long time for, you know, that wound, so to speak, to heal. It never really does, but you sort of come to grips with it that your father is gone. I would say, though, that there are some amazing things to build on that I learned, and I think the best thing to do is what my mom did, was to surround me with a lot of people that knew him, that cared for him, that saw a little bit of him in me. And so it made me feel like they would look at me, and it still happens to this day. They'd be like, wow, you know, Billy would say that. So it made me feel like I was actually carrying on him in a way. Like part of people are still experiencing him through me. And that made me feel good.
Yeah.
The weight of that, though, as you were a kid trying to deal with not only the loss, but the being trying to be there for your mom and your sister. And that's what I kind of feel like that, too, even now. Like, I'm trying to make sure my mom's okay, you know, but you're still dealing with the sadness. That's a lot of weight on an 18-year-old.
Yeah. My mom became this different, unbelievable, because she had to,
strong
leader of the family. Like, she totally transformed and showed off these superpowers that she always had, but she or none of us even knew, you know, because my dad was he was the boss of a company. He was absolutely, you know, somebody that took charge of certain things, but was, you know, a leader in the most respectable way. I think people just liked being around him because he could talk to anybody at any time. He liked, at his own company, you know, the guys who would work in the back room in the warehouse, he could hang with those guys all day long, just as he could a CEO that would come in and sit with him in his office. He'd probably rather hang out with the dudes in the warehouse, you know? And so I kind of like, you know, I saw my mom take on all of these things and completely change right before our eyes. And it was actually very comforting to all of us, knowing that she was going through a lot. But, you know, it is a difficult thing to lose a loved one, no matter when it happens. But I know that at that time, you know, I had to grow up very quickly and be very observant of not only myself, but what was going on around the family. But also, my mom was insistent that I not get too wrapped up in all that. I still had to be a freshman in college. I had to go be an 18-year-old and go do what I'm supposed to do. And I really appreciate her having that perspective as well.
I will say, you know, as much as I'm boo-hooing here, I will say that even at 50, I know it sounds so stupid, but I was always the baby of the family. I'm the youngest of four girls, so you know, I'd let everybody do everything for me. I am proud of myself and the things I had to do to step up. And I lived with my mom at the time. And so there were things I did that I didn't think I could do. So it really does make you kind of aware of your own strength, I guess, even while you're dealing with that. So yeah. I can relate. Yep. I mean, completely different. You were 18. I'm 50. I should have been a grown up at that point, but I wasn't. But it just like you figure things out about yourself that you didn't know.
You do. I mean, I decided to take a leap that week of like going back into what I love, which is sports casting. And so I'll tell you something that happened that week. So my dad died on a Sunday. That week was my graduation gift from high school was a sportscaster's camp at UMSL.
Cool.
And so my mom called the camp and said, Tom's father passed away yesterday. He will not be attending this week. And they said, of course, we understand. You know, we'll refund you. And if you would like to, if he would like to go to any of the days, this is our schedule and he is more than welcome. And so I really didn't feel like talking to anybody. But you know, after the funeral and as the week went along, I did look at the schedule of guests and the last day was Bob Costas was speaking. So I told my mom, I said, on Friday, I think I will go. So I did. So I went and I sat towards the back and I watched Costas speak to the crowd. And I loved Bob, who didn't, as a young sportscaster, want to be Bob Costas. And afterwards, I went up, I stood in line like all the other kids, and I had my binder, and he signed the front of it, Bob Costas, and I went on my way. Well, the director of that camp went to Bob, and he said that that young man who just walked out, I wish I could have caught him, his father passed away, and Bob said, give me his number.
Wow.
And Costas called me at home.
Oh, my gosh.
And my mom said, you know, Tom, you got a phone call. I'm like, I don't really feel like talking to anybody. This was like Saturday. It's the next day. And she said, I think you should take it. It's Bob Costas. I'm like, what?
Was he on Camel X at that time? Where was he in his
career?
He
was at NBC at that time.
Oh, okay.
And I said, Bob, how are you?
Bob, and this is Tom.
As it turns out, his father passed away when he was 18.
Wow.
And he informed me that Jack Buck's dad passed away when he was 18. And he said, you are a lot further along in your broadcasting career than I was at your age. So you're going to do great. And we had this conversation and I hung up the phone. I said, that's it. That's what I want to do. I want to be a sportscaster. That seals
it. Wow, what a neat moment.
And we stayed in touch. Now, my mom and his assistant, Pam Davis, became friends. But Bob and I, you know, corresponded, like this was pre like where everyone had email and texting or anything. So, you know, we sent a postcard to each other every so often. When he found out that I got a job as a part-time producer at KMOX, he couldn't believe it. And, you know, the rest goes on. He and I are still very close friends. But that was something that really, you know, inspired me at the time just by happen. That was only because I decided I'm going to go to this thing. I'm just going to step up and go to this. And I ended up meeting Bob Costas, of all people.
Before we let you go, can you tell your story similar to that about how you got to know Bobby Knight?
Yeah, so my dad was friends with Larry Ziegler. Larry's still doing well. He lives in Orlando, Florida. He was on the PGA Tour. Larry's 84 now, just got inducted in the Missouri Sports Hall of Fame, which was a really fun time for me to be with him. But Larry and my dad went to high school together, and they were at Larry was playing in the Gerald Ford Invitational in Vail while we were on vacation in Colorado. And he said, hey, why don't you guys come to the tournament? It's a celebrity tournament. It's great. And we're like, yeah, great. He said, I'll leave you a couple passes. Come down and see me before I tee off. I'd love to see you. So we go down to the practice green and he said, I'm playing with Bob Knight, who's a great friend of mine. I'm going to call him over. I'm like, oh, my God. I mean, I'm a huge basketball fan. Here comes Coach Knight walking over. Hey, how you doing? Shook hands with him. Yeah, nice to meet you. And Larry, as we're all standing around, he goes, hey, Tommy, you're a caddy in St. Louis. You want a caddy for Coach Knight? I'm like, I look at him. He's like, come on, let's go. So I jump in his golf cart, and we drive to the first tee, and we're chatting on the way. At first, it's awkward silence, and I said, so, Coach, you ready for basketball season? I was like 16. He's like, Tom, I'm never ready for basketball season. I'm just thinking about golf right now. I thought, oh, great. This is off to a great start.
I ruined that one.
But we had a great time. I caddied for him. We chatted a little bit, and he took a liking to me to the point where he asked me where I was looking at college, if I had been looking, and he suggested Indiana. And I followed through on him when he said, how would you like me to set up a tour of campus for you? And I thought, there's no way that he'll remember this, but I said yes. And I got a call from IU 2 weeks later from the athletic department that Coach Knight said you'd be interested in coming to Bloomington. Would you like to take a look around? As it turns out, Coach, because of his loyalty to Larry, reached out to me, he wanted me to be a manager of the basketball team, or at least try out for it. I wanted to be a broadcaster. I went to school my freshman year after my dad passed away. I saw Coach Knight at Assembly Hall. I ran into him in the hallway, and I told him what had happened. He remembered me, and I told him about my dad, and he had not heard. And he put his arm around me, and he said, I'm so sorry. If there's anything that I can do for you, you just let me know. This is my number. And I never called him, but I was in some same, you know, scenarios and classes. He taught a basketball class, and I covered him as a young reporter. And to have that comfort of a legendary figure like that, that I could, if I wanted to, make a phone call, was amazing. And having the softer side of Bob Knight, being able to see that, and it was just another reason why I loved Indiana and I loved being there. And it was such a hard time for me, but having that comfort and level of friendship was unbelievable. And it's all because of loyalty to my dad's friend, Larry Ziegler, and the friendship that my dad had with Larry. This is the effect that my dad had on people.
Thank you, Tommy. Appreciate it, my friend. My next guest is Dr. Julia Strassman, who I met through my work with NODA, No One Dies Alone, at Bethesda here in St. Louis, which I've told you guys about. Julia wanted to kind of introduce you.
What kind of programs does this school have? How are the test scores? How many kids do a classroom? Homes.com knows these are all things you ask when you're home shopping as a parent. That's why each listing on Homes.com includes extensive reports on local schools, including photos, parent reviews, test scores, student-teacher ratio, school rankings, and more. The information is from multiple trusted sources and curated by Homes.com's dedicated in-house research team. It's all so you can make the right decision for your family. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
Flurries of fun await this winter in Indiana. Feel the rush of the Midwest's only refrigerated toboggan run. Ski down snow-covered slopes and marvel at frozen waterfalls on a winter hike. When it's time to unwind, from outdoor fun to indoor escapes, your perfect winter getaway starts in Indiana. Plan your trip today at inindiana.com/winter.
Hey, I'm Josh Fink, owner of Nick's Menswear. Getting married? Don't rent some random suit. At Nick's, we help you own the look for about the same price as a rental. You're marrying the love of your life. Don't you deserve a suit that's yours forever? Nick's Menswear, your friend in style.
Do you believe you were wrongfully terminated for speaking up against your employer? Wilshire Law Firm isn't afraid to go up against corporate giants and will protect you every step of the way. Get justice and feel safe. Call the experts at Wilshire Law Firm at 1-800-800-3333.
Head to Safeway this week for these amazing digital deals for members. Signature Farms chicken, split breasts, drumsticks, or thighs, buy one, get one free of equal or lesser value when you buy two. Or a wheat variety bread, 24-ounce selected varieties, buy one, get one for free of equal or lesser value when you buy two. And Progresso soup, 18 to 19-ounce selected varieties, buy two, get three free of equal or lesser value when you buy five. Visit Safeway.com for more details. See you in the aisles.
Yourself to the audience?
Sure. So, like you said, I'm Dr. Julie Strassman, and I work with Bethesda Hospice Care. So I'm trained as a hospice chaplain, but most of my work right now is in bereavement care, so helping families who've recently lost a loved one.
And how did you get into this way back when?
So I originally saw a posting for a bereavement assistant, and it was really interesting to me because even though I'd never done grief work before, I had my own loss. About 10 years ago, my adopted mom, Aunt Jennifer, died very suddenly and unexpectedly. And no one really teaches you how to grieve. And so especially when you have an unexpected loss, you really don't know how to respond. And so it was very interesting to me to not only try to help other people, but to learn how to cope with my own grief. And in being under the training of the fantastic Leslie Schaefer, who was my mentor and supervisor at the time, I really learned how to help people cope on their grief journey.
So interesting, because we spend about a half an hour, Trish and I, dancing around what you just succinctly said in one sentence, which is no one teaches you how to grieve.
Right.
The best, it seems, is that people will tell you, I'm sorry, I'm here, I loved your dad, I loved your mom, which is helpful, but it gets you 1 yard down a mile run, right?
Right.
And you just don't know. I remember when Nick's mom and I, my 30-year-old son, brought him home. And all the family's there, and it's so exciting. And then when the family left, and it was just the two of us with this little 8-pound meatloaf, we had no idea what to do. We had no idea what's the next step. What do we do? And that's similar to at least how I felt.
And two, I want to ask Julie, like, there's probably not a correct amount of time. Like, if you're thinking, oh, I'm grieving not enough, or I'm grieving too long, I would imagine that every person is probably different. But are there, like, okay, this has gone on way too long?
Yeah, absolutely. Everyone's unique journey is really different. But what I would say is, one of the things I always ask people when they're worried, you know, am I grieving too long? Am I grieving too deeply? I really think about, how are you functioning in daily life, right? Are you being able to go to work? Are you being able to eat? Are you being able to sleep? Those things are really difficult in the first days and weeks, and sometimes even in the first months. But if you've gone past 6 months and you're still really struggling to just do your daily activities of life, that's definitely when it's time to reach out to a grief counselor.
Well, I said this to Dave too. It's been, you know, it's been 2 years. I think about it every day. I'm performing the motions of daily life, and I am, and I'm enjoying things. It's not like it's taking over my days, but it's a hole I don't know how to fill yet. So I'm still sad about it. And it's still, I think I said this earlier too, I don't know who I am without my dad in my life, but it's not stopping me from performing, you know, my daily task or the things you just said. I'm like, oh, I'm all fine on that. I just don't know how to fill that hole in.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't know if there's anything that really does fill that hole in. I think what I really liked was the word that you used, enjoy, right? Because you use the words of function and the words enjoy. And if you're functioning, but you're just kind of going through the motions, you probably could use some extra support. But if you are still finding joy, then you know that even though you're grieving, you're still being able to live your life fully and with meaning. And a lot of times, the best thing that people can really do to kind of fill that hole, as you said, is to do things that honor your loved one and that help you feel connected to your loved one. There's really nothing that's going to fill their absence in your life, but a lot of people find a lot of meaning and purpose by maybe getting involved in causes that were important to that person, doing things to keep family traditions alive that meant a lot to that person. Just keeping their values alive in the world through your actions can be a really great way to feel connected with them and kind of be able to find joy and meaning at the same time.
So how much, I was talking earlier in the podcast about my work with NODA, and although I've only sat with a few people who were emergently dying, it's made such a huge difference. Talk about the difference it has made to you being around so many people who were passing, who passed in front of you, who you then counseled their loved ones afterwards. Just what death has come to mean to you as opposed to what it meant before all this?
Sure, absolutely. Well, I think no one teaches you how to grieve, and no one teaches you how to be with someone who's dying, right? Most people don't know the physical signs and symptoms, and so they, when the transition is happening, they really don't know what is taking place. And that can be really scary. You know, for most people, especially folks who are on hospice, their passing is really comfortable and peaceful. So being with someone as they take their last breaths can actually be a really sacred and meaningful experience. And so I think for a lot of people, what really helps them is to just understand what's happening as it's happening. And that way they can concentrate on just being present in that moment and being present for their loved one. So if you're with someone who's dying, a lot of times you won't really know what's happening with their breathing. You know, a lot of times people's breathing will really slow down. It will change. You know, it can be really anxiety ridden if you are kind of watching someone, you know, slowly stop breathing. And but at the same time, it's very comfortable and it's very natural. And so I actually just sat vigil with my grandmother this past Saturday. My family was taking turns sitting vigil. She was on hospice. And as she started to get closer to transitioning, her breaths became farther and farther apart. You know, they became 30 seconds apart eventually. And I was texting my family, letting them know, you know, I think grandma's really close. And my aunt said, you know, have you told the nurses? And I said, you know, I don't think I need to. You know, they're not going to do anything at this moment. There's nothing they really can do. I just want to be here and be present with my grandmother while she takes her last breath. Mm. And so knowing what was happening, not being afraid of it, knowing that it was perfectly natural and that she was comfortable, allowed me to just be there with her in the moment. And that is a memory that I will cherish the rest of my life.
Yeah.
It was a very sacred moment.
Let's talk a little bit about reconciling. Trish and I have very different families, and I love my family. I love my mom and my dad, but I had a fairly chaotic, anxiety-ridden childhood. And my mom, both of them were complicated people, but my mom really was probably one of the only true geniuses I've ever known. Like, she really was. She was like next level smart. And, but we clashed, like, you know, a lot of kids and their parents. And there were some things from my childhood that were fairly horrific. And we only really talked about them one time years and years ago. And it didn't go well. And so in the last 2 days that she was with us, and you and Chrissy, the hospice nurse, had said she has like a couple of days. She has hours. And, you know, lots of family were there. And at one point, it was just me and her. And I took the opportunity to hold her hand and look her in the eye and say, we need to do something here. I need to ask you to forgive me. Now I'm going to cry. for anything and everything that I've ever done. Yeah. And for in any way limiting you in my mind as a person or as a parent. And I need you to know that I forgive you for any shortcomings, for anything that your childhood nailed onto your feet to make you walk funny. And it was so meaningful, and it lasted 2 minutes. But when other people came back in the room, I was substantially changed. Mm. And I'm so thankful that I got to do that. And so maybe you can talk a bit about the importance of making amends and forgiving.
Oh, absolutely. So there's a really fantastic book by Dr. Ira Byock. I think it's called The Four Things That Matter Most. And I extend it to five things. So when a person is in the last stage of their life, especially if they can still talk to you, but even if they can't, you know, the most important things that you can do are to say thank you. Thank you for everything that you've done in my life to support me, even if you weren't a perfect person. Most people have done something, you know, that made a difference in your life. Next is, I forgive you. I forgive you for the ways that you may have hurt me over the years. And next, will you forgive me for the ways that I may have hurt you? And then the next is to say, I love you. And then finally to say goodbye. And I think that these are things that you can have a conversation with some people, and with other people, it's okay to do these things when they're not responsive. If there's anything that still needs to be said, when I'm sitting vigil with family members, one of the things that I always take time to do is to say, if there's anything that you haven't said yet to your loved one that you will regret not saying, now's the time to say it. Because many people, even when they're unresponsive, we believe they can still hear us. And sometimes they'll even give us, you know, little signs that they can still hear us. So, yes, absolutely. Say those things. One of the other things that I do, and I'm trained as a hospice chaplain, so this is appropriate for my spiritual tradition, is I will ask the Holy Spirit what the person needs to hear in this moment. And if that's not your spirituality, you can ask the universe and say, what does my loved one need to hear in this moment? And I actually did that with my grandmother just a few days ago when I was sitting vigil with her. And I didn't really get much at first, which I was kind of happy about. It meant that there wasn't anything left to be said. But then I did get this feeling that maybe I needed to offer forgiveness as well, because I also come from a family of generational trauma. And so I said, Grandma, I love you so much. I'm so grateful for everything that you did for me over the years. I love you and I forgive you. I forgive you. I know you did your best and I will always love you.
On the flip side of that, if people don't get that chance, if they're not sitting with them at that moment or they don't know that death is imminent, like what do you say to people who didn't get those last words in or didn't get to say, I'm sorry or I forgive you or I love you or any of that?
Well, I never think it's too late, you know, and again, this depends on your spirituality, but many people believe that they can, you know, still be in communication with their loved ones. Also, even if it's just for your own personal well-being, I think it's great to still say these things. You can say them out loud. Some people like to do that at a place that's particularly special, like the gravesite, or write a letter. Write a letter to your loved one. So it really depends on your tradition and your spirituality, but I think it's never too late necessarily to say these things.
I don't know how much your training is on this, but in my particular situation, my dad just kind of went to the hospital and never spoke again. He was doing this weird thing, though, where his eyes would open and his arms would move out like he was punching something and his legs were moving, almost like he was trying to get out of something. Like that's the only way I can put it. And I don't know. Obviously, we don't know what they're thinking or... You know, he kept doing that. And then I just kept wondering, like, is he scared? Like, is something bad happening? Like, is he suffering? Mm-hmm. And then I don't know how much you know or what they tell you at that end of life stage in regards to that.
Sure. Well, there's a couple different ways to look at it, right? Because from a medical stance, what you're finding is that people's metabolism is changing at that time. It's very difficult for the body to regulate any of the things it would normally regulate. And so people tend to have restlessness during the last stage of their life. It doesn't necessarily mean that they're in pain, but there is this restlessness that just kind of comes over the body. And so in hospice, one of the things that we do is we use medications to help relax the person, right? And so you see less of that restlessness. And then there's the spiritual plane, right? And we don't know for sure what's happening during that time, but we can be there for them. We can, you know, speak reassuring words to them. One of the things that I do when I'm sitting vigil with someone, if they're really restless, I will try a couple different interventions. So first I'll try things that might calm and relax them. So I'll speak to them in a very calm and reassuring voice. I might play some soft music for them. I might gently touch them just to let them know that, you know, I'm here with them. If I notice that the restlessness continues or even increases, then I decrease the amount of stimulation. So I might make the lights a little bit lower. I might turn off music or turn off the TV. I might reduce the amount that I touch them and just sit quietly with them. Some people get more agitated with some stimulation, some people less so. So you kind of have to find what works for each person. But again, even though these things are very uncomfortable to witness, especially when you love the person so much and you don't want to see them suffer, they are part of the natural process of dying. And in hospice, of course, we use lots of medical interventions and emotional and spiritual interventions to try to help calm those things, but they are still natural.
That doesn't mean that they're in pain.
Doesn't necessarily mean that they're in pain, right? Exactly. Restlessness is not the same as pain. Restlessness can be a sign of pain, but not necessarily. It can also just be metabolic changes in the body.
Yeah. When my mom passed, was passing, it was from the training I took with you guys later at NOTA. It was so classic because they talk about people reaching out, mm-hmm. possibly to loved ones, mm-hmm. to heaven. And my mom was doing that. Mm-hmm. And then the afternoon of the day she died, like my kids were saying goodbye to her, which, of course, watching your children say yeah. goodbye to your parent is like, it's so emotional. And then it wasn't like I took my turn. I just held her hand And one of the most meaningful things was she leaned over and she kissed my hand 3 times.
Aww, that's beautiful.
So, yeah, it was like, you're special.
Yeah.
You know.
It's a good moment. I'm a mess.
I hope this has been good for someone. This has been hard for us.
Well, that was the main thing. It was like, I know that if I'm still feeling this, like other people are feeling this and you don't know what to do with it. It's not, it doesn't mean it's necessarily a bad thing. I don't feel like it's ruining my life, what I'm thinking, but it's just with me. And I've said this a couple times. It's always to my left. And I just try not to look to my left all day because I'll just be a mess all day. Like, it's just always there. And I just loved him so much. And, you know, when you lose someone for the first time that was that impactful on your life and you know it's going to happen again, it's like I'm just trying to steel myself for the next time. And it's, you know, it's hard, obviously.
Yeah.
Thank you. Well, and every experience is different too, right? You know, especially if it's someone that you have, you know, a lot of unresolved issues with, or if it's a situation where you're worried that they're suffering or they're in pain, it's going to take longer, right? For you to, and I, there's really no getting over grief necessarily, but there's getting to a point where you feel like you're being able to live without it kind of hanging over you.
Managing it better.
Well, I don't even know if I'd use the term managing it, right? Because what we really hope will happen over time is that you'll continue to think about this person, but the pain of their loss will gradually decrease while the memories that you have of them stay with you. And so sometimes what I'll talk, when I talk to people who have been grieving for a long time and it still feels like it's a big part of their life, like the grief still feels really big.
So mistake is clearly the wrong word, but it's the one that's coming into my mind. As people are grieving, and if they were to seek help from you, are there any things, given that everyone grieves differently and everyone's an individual, but are there red flags where you'll say, I think this person could use a little more help?
Sure, absolutely. So I think a lot of it is about intensity and timeline. And there's really no set timeline for grief, but usually you're going to see a lot of intensity at the beginning. You're going to see some intensity at dates that are important, you know, holidays, birthdays, anniversaries. And you might just see, you know, some random spikes in grief here and there. But if it's really starting to get in a person's way to being able to function and to be able to find joy, that's when I say it's really time to reach out to a counselor. And like I said, I'm trained as a chaplain, but a counselor or a therapist has much more tools that they can provide for a person. Trish, to your earlier point about managing grief. So a lot of times when I think about managing grief, it's really about allowing yourself to find ways to feel connected to the person while slowly letting go of the pain. And so a lot of people start to get to a point where they're worried that if they're not feeling the pain of the loss, that they're not as connected to their loved ones, right? Sometimes people think, oh, I'm starting to feel a little bit better. Oh, now I'm guilty about that. I shouldn't be feeling better because that means I'm forgetting them or I love them less. And that's not the case at all, right? It's not the pain of the grief that connects you to them. It's the way that they shaped your life. It's the memories that you have of them. It's the way that their legacy continues on through you and your family. And so I really try to encourage people to focus less on the pain, especially over time, and more on the connection.
One more question about kind of this, but people who obviously lose someone, but then start thinking about their own mortality and are scared of it. What do you, you know, that's kind of on my brain and
what
it's
a great question.
Making me think about it and I'm scared of it.
Sure. Well, and again, this is so unique to a person's personal beliefs, right? To their spirituality, to the way that they understand life and death. And so I always ask people, you know, if they're afraid, take some time to think specifically what you're afraid of. Are you afraid of the dying process? Like, will it hurt or what will it be like? Are you afraid of what happens afterwards? And then it's time to explore your spirituality. Are you afraid of the legacy that you leave behind? And maybe there are things that you haven't done yet that you still want to do. So really take some time to think about what is it that's bothering you. And then you can find support for each of those areas.
If people locally would like to get involved with No One Dies Alone or hospice work in general, what do you suggest?
Absolutely. So there are many hospices across the country. All of them take volunteers. Not all of them will have a No One Dies Alone program, but they'll all have a volunteer program. And it can be so meaningful to be with people in those last stages of life. So I would recommend finding a hospice near you and reaching out.
Thank you, Julie. Appreciate it.
Absolutely.
Okay. It feels like we've been doing this for 12 hours.
I know. I'm a mess. It's exhausting.
Final thoughts?
I just feel for anyone who's dealing with a loss. That's just it. And there's not a lot you can do to help. Well, I feel like, there's not really a lot of things people can say or do. Yeah. It's just, you got to just deal with it. And I'm so sorry for anyone who's going through that.
Yeah, I'm sure no one tuned in today thinking that they were going to hear the answer.
Right.
I don't think there is the answer. But from listening to our stories and listening to Tom Ackerman and listening to Julie, hopefully you've gleaned something helpful or at least felt a part of a community that you didn't know existed.
You're not alone.
Yes.
People are also having those thoughts. And, feel free to reach out to us. I would just love to send you an email back saying, hey, I hear you.
Absolutely.
That's it.
Absolutely. Okay. We hope you guys enjoyed this and got something out of it. And we'll talk to you again soon.
College holds a mythic place in American culture. On the new Campus Files podcast, we uncover the scandals you won't hear on the campus tours. Find Campus Files on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.